From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take 2, me Martinez. Over the next 2 years, the city of Santa Monica projects a deficit of over $200 million. While they're planning to lay off hundreds of employees to offset the losses, we'll hear what programs and services will be cut alongside those layoffs. Plus, Disney reports $1 billion in revenue losses. Find out why they have been particularly vulnerable to the coronavirus pandemic. It's all ahead on Take 2. From 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app, this is Take 2. I'm Amy Martinez. Thanks for joining us today. Later on in the show, we're going to dig into some of the severe budget cuts our communities are facing due to the economic punch of COVID-19. Plus, we're also going to go back to the 1930s and another sort of bailout that helped musicians from L.A. and all over the U.S. make it through the Great Depression.
At this time, it is our pleasure to present the Los Angeles Colored Chorus, a unit of the Works Progress Administration's Federal Music Project, under the direction of Dr. Nikolai Sokolov. Now a modern song based on a spiritual theme, Great Day.
When night was dark, came Noah's Ark. Amen.
That's coming up. But first, Los Angeles County Supervisor Catherine Barger announced that hiking trails, golf courses, florists, car dealers, and various retail stores can open up again for business on Friday, lining up with plans that were outlined by Governor Gavin Newsom earlier this week. All these moves to reopen really place a special importance not only on increasing testing capacities, but also on contact tracing. That's a crucial component in helping us track the coronavirus and also keep it contained. Now, today marks the start of a new program announced earlier this week by Newsom. That's to train as many as 20,000 people to trace the spread of the virus. The administration has partnered with UCLA and the University of California, San Francisco to provide online and in-person training to state employees selected for the program. They will be on course to become what the governor has called disease detectives. Dylan Scott is a health reporter for Vox, and he's been covering all the moving pieces of contact tracing. Dylan, welcome to Take 2.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Now, Dylan, the state is looking at training 3,000 people a week starting today for many weeks to come. What will they be trained to do exactly? What will be the job of these disease detectives?
So the essence of contact tracing is pretty simple, actually. So you have a person who tests positive for a disease, COVID-19 in our case. And so a disease intervention specialist or a disease detective, somebody who does the work of contact tracing, gets in touch with that person and basically just conducts an interview, asks them, you know, when did you start feeling sick? What were you doing a couple of days before that? What have you been doing since you got sick? And most importantly, who have you been in close physical contact with recently? You know, have you left your house? Did you go out to a store, you know, go out to a park and spend some time around people? You know, who have you been in touch with? What if you have been in touch with people, what do you have their contact information so that we can get in touch with them? And so then after that initial interview with the person who's actually tested positive for the disease, the contact tracers will get in touch with all the people who might have been potentially exposed, inform them of their potential exposure, and then ask them to, at a minimum, self-quarantine, isolate themselves, so if they did get the virus, they're not going to spread it to anybody else, and if possible, to go and get tested, though, of course, that is dependent on testing being available. So the essence of it is interviewing people, finding out who their contacts are, and then getting in touch with their contacts so that they know about their risks of exposure. That's the essence of it, and it's pretty simple in that regard.
Yeah, to try and get as clear of a picture of this as possible. Now, how critical is training more people to do contact tracing, especially as California tries to get into the next phase of reopening?
So every public health expert I've talked to has said two things are critical to reopening the economy. One, having more testing available, and two, contact tracing. Because, you know, the risk right now, everybody's locked down. The disease is pretty well contained to, you know, households. You know, if you get it, you're not likely to spread it to many more people than the people that you live with. But once people start going back out to stores, going back out into public, there's a lot more potential for exposure. And so what we want to do is clamp down on new emerging outbreaks before they really begin. And that's where contact tracing comes in. Because if you have one person who could potentially spread it to five other people, and then they could potentially spread it to five other people, and round we go, what contact tracing is able to do is cut off those second and third layers of transmission. If you get a person who tests positive, you find out who their contacts are and get those people to self-isolate, hopefully you've got a contained new outbreak rather than one that's spiraling out of control. You know, as a public health official I talked to up in King County, Washington, told me, you know, this is the way to prevent a few little sparks from growing into a forest fire.
So,
and so that it really contact tracing is critical if we want to start relaxing social distancing.
Then on that note, then having an extra 20,000 people doing this work, being disease detectives, what kind of an impact could that possibly have?
So that does seem like about the number that you'd need to do this kind of work in a state as big as California. The National Association of County and City Health Officials has said that, you know, and all of these are rough estimates, but they said they think we need about 30 contact tracers for every 100,000 Americans to keep a good track of the pandemic and control any emerging outbreaks. And so if you translate that to California's population of about 40 million people, that means you need at least 12,000 people trained to do this work. So the numbers that the state government there is talking about do seem to kind of align with what the experts say we'll need. Now, I think it's kind of to be determined exactly how many people we need. The researchers at Johns Hopkins said we need 100,000 people nationwide. Mm. Tom Frieden, who ran the CDC for President Obama, said it's more like 300,000. But I think where everybody agrees is we need a lot more people. And so I think that the goal that California has set makes sense here at the onset because, you know, we don't know how many people we're going to get to volunteer to do this or hired to do this. Then we have to train them. But it is clear that we need a pretty exponential increase in the number of people trained to do this kind of disease detecting. And so I think that's what's reflected in California's goal.
We're talking about contact tracing with Dylan Scott, a health reporter for Vox. Now, in your piece, you remind us that contact tracing isn't a new thing. We do it all the time for HIV and sexually transmitted diseases, even the measles, we've done that. What are some unique challenges, though, as we face a respiratory disease like COVID-19?
I mean, I think in one sense, it's pretty simple, right? Like with an STD, you've either had sex with somebody or you haven't. And that's a pretty binary situation. And if you ask somebody, as uncomfortable as it might be at times, who their sexual partners are, they should be able to tell you with pretty easily. But with a respiratory disease, you're now asking people, you know, well, who have you been within 6 feet of for at least 15 minutes over the last week? And that becomes a much more difficult kind of criteria to nail down. Some of the deceased, the contact tracers I've spoke with said, you know, you have to do a lot more work to jog people's memories. Now, one upside is, you know, there is unfortunately still a lot of stigma around HIV and STDs, and sometimes people are reluctant to share their sex life with a stranger. One thing that the public health workers I've talked to have said is that with COVID-19, people do tend to be very forthcoming. They're worrying about who they might have infected, and so they're almost eager to talk to somebody to try to get their contacts established and get those people notified. But in terms of actually knowing who you've potentially exposed, it's a little more of a guessing game than it is with something as direct as sexually transmitted diseases.
So to eliminate some of the guesswork, what about digital contact tracing using phone apps, maybe with Bluetooth tech proposed by Apple or Google to maybe trace those who have been infected? How important would that be in addition to having the army of disease detectives at work on this?
So as I understand it, there's a lot of potential in using Bluetooth technology to basically have our phones silently track who we come into close physical contact with so we don't have to try to remember. But the trick is getting a lot of people to adopt it, because if you only have like 10% of people who are really using these kind of digital contact tracing apps, you're not getting nearly enough penetration to really have any chance at the kind of containment you'd want to be looking for. And then you're really just drawing resources and attention away from traditional contact tracing, you know, hiring new workers and training them. And so at that point, maybe it's not really worth the investment. What experts have said is we probably need about 60% of people to, you know, use these apps in order for them to have the desired effect. And right now, we're really not seeing that level of penetration. Even like a country like Singapore that's much more tech savvy, there's maybe not as much distrust between the citizenry and the government when it comes to surveillance as we have in the United States. And even there, they're only looking about 20% as of, I think, last week of people who have been willing to download and use these apps. So I think for the time being, experts would tell you there's a lot of potential in digital contact tracing. If we can get widespread adoption, it could automate a lot of the work that we ask disease detectives to do. But until we reach that degree of widespread mainstream acceptance, the focus needs to be on this traditional kind of contact tracing, spending the money and the resources to get people hired and trained to do the real grunt work, rather than thinking that, you know, these new apps are going to swoop in and save us.
Dylan Scott is a healthcare reporter for Vox. Dylan, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, now let's turn back to one city in Southern California that's been struggling to stay afloat in this crisis, and that's the beach community of Santa Monica. Despite it being rich with tourism and industry, it's suffering major cutbacks as its economy falters. And last night, the city council voted on a plan that would result in layoffs of almost 250 government employees. To discuss all of this, we have Lane Dilg, Santa Monica's interim city manager. Welcome back.
Nice to be with you.
And nice to have you. Now, before we get to the cuts, walk us through the numbers a bit. You've made projections out until June of 2022. What's the financial outlook for the city heading into June 2022?
So we are looking at a $48 million deficit in our current fiscal year, which ends June 30th, $102 million deficit in the next fiscal year, and a $74 million deficit in fiscal year 2021-2022.
So adding all of that up, we're talking about $224 million projected?
That's correct.
Wow. All right, so what are some of the factors, the biggest factors contributing to that shortfall?
Our projections show a 14% decrease in sales tax revenue next fiscal year. Hotel taxes are projected to drop 42% next fiscal year. And our parking revenues are expected to be about down about 21.7%. So across the board, across many of our revenue streams, we're simply facing unexpected and fairly devastating decreases in the amount of revenue coming into the city.
So fair to say we're talking about visitors here, whether it's someone visiting from, say, somewhere else in California or somewhere far away. It's tourism related.
It is tourism related, largely, though we are seeing it across all of our revenue streams.
Now, because this projection lane is so far into the future, does that mean that your team does not foresee many ways to make it up through maybe cuts or finding other new revenue sources?
At this point, we've identified $117 million in one-time funds from our rainy day funds, reductions of our capital improvement projects, and other sources that will help us to bridge the gap. But that's one-time money, and the numbers that I mentioned before, our deficits are long and structural, and our community needs have also changed. So what we're looking to do is restructure our government operations to run a slightly smaller government operation focused on the true needs of our community coming out of COVID-19.
Because of these problems, the city council voted last night on a new budget plan. And part of that, over 20% of the city's workforce could either be laid off, let go, or maybe receive a buyout. That will be addressed later this month. But what services might take the biggest hits?
We will have to make cuts to a number of programs and services that the members of our community love and that our staff love. Our Office of Civic Well-being, our Office of Performance Management, many of the things that Santa Monica has long run individual offices devoted to values, we'll have to scale that back and imbue the values across the organization rather than running individual programs. We're also looking at reducing hours across some of our community facilities, our much beloved swim center and skate park, for example, and we will have to reduce our library services.
Okay, so how did you determine which departments and which services would have to face the biggest cuts?
So we focused first on what our priorities are. As a result of the impacts of COVID-19, what do we need in terms of emergency response? What will our community members newly need when we reemerge from this? And also as we continue to deal with the public health impacts. And then we focused on what do we need for economic recovery? So what are the processes within the city that help local businesses to get back on their feet? After identifying those priorities, we went through department by department and tried to determine what was most impacted by COVID-19, what was most realistic to run in the future, and where we could truly continue to serve the community versus what needed to be scaled back.
How much community outreach was done to determine maybe what the residents of Santa Monica felt that needed to be cut or needed to stick around?
So we have heard from many, many residents in this process, and particularly with respect to the council meeting last night. What we heard from the community is that they were very concerned, particularly about after-school programs and programs focused on vulnerable populations and vulnerable youth. Our city council did hear from them. As part of our plan, we had left some funds for the city council to allocate based on what they heard from the community. And they did do that last night, determining some priorities for us to spend some remaining ongoing funds to make sure we heard from the community and are able to address some of those needs.
Now, I know LA decided to furlough civilian city workers, basically giving them a 10% pay cut instead of going to layoffs. And there might be further negotiations to be done over the layoffs in your city, in Santa Monica. But what went into the decision to first cut staff in your city first?
We simply don't get out of this without a reduction in the size of the city government that we're operating. We are not similarly situated to LA. Our reliance on tourism is slightly higher. We run a different kind of city government, and we're not receiving direct federal aid. So cities under 500,000 are currently excluded from direct federal aid. LA has that money coming. We don't. So those are some of the differences with LA.
And Lane, if these layoffs do wind up happening, how much consideration will demographics go into the people that to get laid off?
The positions to be eliminated were identified based on the priorities that I just mentioned to you. So it wasn't about people, it was about positions and what kind of city government we should be running. With respect to how that will impact people, we were directed by City Council and took seriously making cuts at all levels of the organization. And we expect that will be true and will be shown in the demographics and also just in the positions cut. It's all levels. It's management positions. It's leadership positions. It's people who are out in the field. It really is across the board. We are trying to restructure the government to meet new priorities.
Talking to Lane Dilg, Santa Monica's interim city manager. Now, the city was already facing budget shortfalls before the crisis because of things such as underfunded pensions. So wondering, Lane, did this pandemic just accelerate what maybe was inevitable for Santa Monica?
Most California cities face significant unfunded pension liability, and we are no different. We have gotten out ahead of some other cities on our pension liability with an aggressive 13-year repayment plan to try to pay down that unfunded liability. Because of COVID-19, we will have to skip this year's payment and transition to a 15-year repayment plan. So we will make some progress on that, but our progress in reducing that unfunded liability will absolutely be delayed.
Wondering what state or federal lifelines are you exploring right now?
So we're advocating for funds from the federal and state government. We're doing that on an ongoing basis. We know that the state faces shortfalls and deficits just like we do. So the state received some money from federal governments that it can allocate to small cities. We are working hard with our representatives to try to obtain some of those funds, but we're also aware that none of that is certain and that the ultimate amounts that we are likely to recover simply are not large enough to make a real dent in the deficits that we're facing.
How has the federal government and the state government been through all this? Have you felt like Santa Monica is almost like you got to kind of fend for yourself in a way?
We've been in close touch with all of our representatives at the state and federal levels, and we do believe they're advocating for us. We're not optimistic at this point that we see significant sums from the federal or the state government. If they're out there listening, we do need the funds. We need them now. Please send them. We're saying that every day. We're not optimistic that they actually come into hand in time or in sufficient size to really make a dent in the problems that we're facing.
That's Lane Dilg, Santa Monica's interim city manager. Lane, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, budget cuts are the new current normal for a lot of things right now. Businesses, you just heard about the city of Santa Monica, and that pretty much lines up with other local governments. And now departments within those local governments are feeling the economic pinch. Coming up, how one of them tasked with the public safety is going to have to make do with a much smaller wallet. Find out which one when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Baby, I'm yours.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and also KPCC.org. I'm Ian Martinez. LA County Sheriff Alex Villanueva says he's being forced to make deep cuts to public safety. The reason, he says, the Board of Supervisors voted last week to give him $400 million less than what he requested for the fiscal year that starts in July. The sheriff says he has no choice now but to close two patrol stations and shut down several special investigative units, among other things. KPCC's Frank Stoltz joins us for a closer look at the sheriff's budget. Frank, welcome back.
Hey.
Now, well, first off, how bad is it?
Well, we should keep in mind that the supervisors are worried more broadly about a projected massive loss of sales tax revenue because of the coronavirus pandemic, which you were just talking about. Sheriff Villanueva requested $3.9 billion. Supervisors have tentatively voted to give him $3.5 billion. That's $400 million less. This is about what was allocated last year, but because of inflation and pay raises for the department's 18,000 employees required under labor contracts, the sheriff needs to do some belt tightening.
All right. So how does he plan to do that?
First of all, he wants to close a couple of patrol stations, Altadena and Marina Del Rey, two of the county's 23 stations. That's not unprecedented. He said that that's been done before, the sheriff, during tough times. The La Crescenta station would cover for Altadena, for instance, and the South LA station would cover for the Marina Del Rey area. Also in his plan, the department's Parks Bureau would be closed instead. Deputies from stations near the county's more than 100 parks and trails and golf courses would patrol those areas. There wouldn't be a special bureau. And the sheriff is also wanting to close the Community Partnership Bureau and specialized detective units that focus on things like sexual assaults, gangs, major crimes, and cyber crimes. He says no one will lose their job, but through savings on administrative costs and others, he hasn't spelled out just yet. Villanueva says these moves will save nearly $200 million.
All right, Frank. Now, that last part, though, you mentioned the special detective units. That sounds pretty serious. I mean, should we be worried about public safety now?
Yeah, it's hard to tell exactly how serious it's going to be. Remember, nobody's going to be laid off. People will be transferred to other areas of the department. And some might say that the sheriff was playing politics during this news conference earlier this week to a certain extent when he announced the shrinking of his 6-person homeless outreach team.
And they've been doing an outstanding job serving the homeless community, particularly right now in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic. Unfortunately, we wanted to expand this to 40 deputies. The board no longer wants to fund it, so we're going to have to withdraw them.
So, in fact, the board did not recommend closing the homeless outreach unit, as he suggested. It recommended against its expansion. So the homeless outreach team will continue.
So it sounds like this, you know, could raise a point about how the sheriff fits into the structure of county government. I mean, doesn't it?
Well, so what's going on here is sort of a back and forth between the independently elected sheriff and the Board of Supervisors. While the board decides how much money he gets, the sheriff alone decides how to spend it. So it's a little misleading when he says the board refuses to fund homeless outreach, for instance. It's the sheriff who's deciding to fund something other than homeless outreach.
The thing is, though, Frank, you and I have talked about this. We know that Villanueva and the Board of Supervisors are not pals.
Not at all. They fought over a whole range of issues over the last year and a half. The rehiring of former Deputy Carl Mandoyan, who'd been fired over allegations of domestic violence. He ended dozens of disciplinary investigations before there was a final finding. He's deferential to the union. But most frustrating to the board is his deficit spending. $63 million his first year, $89 million projected this year. Villanueva says they just need to give him more money. And on Monday, he projected the supervisor's faces up on a screen and made a plea to the public to ask the supervisors why they didn't fully fund his budget request.
And I urge you, if you live in one of their districts, this is your supervisor of your district, these are their contact information, please reach out to them and ask for the information. You can also ask them for this bit of information. We need to see the proposed budget submitted by every single department head.
So, A, here's the sheriff stoking the fire with the board and also stoking the fire with his fellow department heads, wants to see their numbers so that perhaps he can get more money. It's not the greatest political move, you might say, anyone's made recently. The board maintains that Villanueva simply needs to rein in his big spending, and especially as the county faces this projected $1 billion drop in sales tax revenue because of the coronavirus pandemic.
That's KPCC's Frank Stoltz filling us in on the roughly $200 million in cuts in Sheriff Alex Villanueva's budget announced for his department. Frank, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, now for an uplifting story. KPCC's Eric Galindo has been chronicling the impact of the coronavirus on Latino communities for LAS.com with his column Mis Angeles. Through the economic downturn of this pandemic is hitting some groups particularly hard, especially low-income families, his latest installment follows three interwoven stories of kindness and one very successful family recipe.
This is a story about four women from Linwood, but it's a story about all of us. It's also about Menudo. There's one woman working out of a closet, a makeshift radio studio where she broadcasts from home as part of On Air with Ryan Seacrest. There's another woman, a Linwood School District employee, standing in a church parking lot wearing a mask and handing out grocery gift cards to needy families. Another woman, an abuela, is in her kitchen having a panic attack because the son who she lives with and who supports her just lost his job. Then there's Miriam Rojo, the abuela's 20-year-old granddaughter, who gets one of those gift cards and does something basic but brilliant, which is the magic tying this story together.
My husband and father had both lost their jobs and grandma was having a breakdown, Miriam told me on the phone. So I had this $100 gift card they gave me and I was thinking about how I can turn it into more. So I told my grandma, can you make your menudo? We can sell it.
And so she did. And everyone got involved.
My husband does supply runs, I handle the orders, my dad does the deliveries.
The family Sinaloa-style menudo has been selling out every weekend since they started making it. They've even started selling handmade flour tortillas, a specialty of Sinaloa ranchos. A Sinaloa rancho is where this story starts for the Rojo family. All of them are immigrants. Miriam, Grandma Rojo, and much of the family are undocumented, so they don't qualify for unemployment or government aid, like a stimulus check. For me, the story started with my good friend, Patty Rodriguez, an on-air personality on Kiss FM and a book publisher who raised nearly $10,000 on Instagram to buy groceries for families in her hometown of Linwood. Linwood is filled with families like the Rojos who have been decimated economically by the pandemic and whom the government, which benefits greatly from their cheap labor and billions in tax revenue, has largely forgotten.
I feel as a Latina still navigating my way through life and career in this country, I have a responsibility to help,
Patty told me. She was speaking from the closet she has turned into an office and a radio studio.
That's why I do what I do. That's why I help. Because I am them, and they are me.
When I spoke to her, Patty had been up since 5 a.m. working on the Ryan Seacrest radio show. She hadn't eaten all day, and she was thinking about food. But she was also thinking about her responsibility to help others. A few weeks ago, that sense of responsibility had moved Patty to call the city of Linwood to see if she could help children and their families. She was worried her hometown school district would be forgotten.
Big donors help LAUSD. Smaller districts in LA County don't get the support. They're always forgotten. I just wanted to help the students and their families in Linwood.
It just so happens, Audrey Casas, a 20-year veteran of the Linwood Unified School District, was already trying to independently raise money to do that. Through a mutual friend, Patty and Audrey got connected. Patty sent Audrey $1,000, which bought 10 families groceries. Patty said she had wanted to help for a while, but she was unsure how. She had a suspicion many of her 100,000 Instagram followers would feel the same way.
I have a platform, and I'm grateful that I have been able to create a community with such a big heart,
Patty said. In the past, her Instagram followers have stepped up to help raise money for migrant families and other causes close to Patty's heart. They came through again, contributing the total of $10,000. The donation went to Audrey, who by this time, in just a few weeks, had created an organization that was raising thousands of dollars and feeding hundreds of families on a regular basis. I called Audrey to see how she did this, and from the moment she began speaking, I felt electrified by her energy. She spoke eloquently and passionately and pretty much nonstop for 20 minutes.
A lot of our students were telling me their mom or dad just lost their job,
Audrey said.
I was losing sleep. I was like, I can't keep hearing these stories and not doing anything.
Audrey posted a call for donations on her Instagram page. Like a spiderweb of generosity, she started connecting with people. Now she has a small but effective network of charities and donors that are feeding thousands of people in Southeast LA County.
It's amazing to see what we can do. It's like we're all connected. It's just people who know people who know people who know people coming together to help each other.
But it's not just about being in need. It's also about how the community hustles. At the same time those wheels were turning, the Rojos were looking at a bleak situation. Miriam Rojo's family was broke. The family's providers were unemployed. Her baby and toddler were hungry, and the landlord was asking for at least part of the rent. Then about 4 weeks ago, she saw a post on Instagram from Audrey at the school district saying some local families could get food assistance, thanks to Patty's initial donation.
I was embarrassed at first, but I finally sent Audrey a message asking for help,
Miriam recalled.
And she brought over a $100 gift card. Instead of spending it one time and not having money again later, I flipped it. Flipped it into menudo ingredients, that is. That menudo and all the menudo that has followed is providing a small but steady income stream.
I asked Miriam what it felt like to be able to support her family right now. I asked her if her grandma was proud that her menudo saved her family from what feels like the end of the world. She said they were both proud to be part of LA's long tradition of hustle and survival. And menudo too. I'm Eric Galindo.
Eric chronicles life in Los Angeles for LAist in his column, Mis Angeles. And you can read this column on our website. That's LAist.com, LAIST.com. Coronavirus stories can have a tendency to change from one week to the next. And that can make it challenging for reporters whose job it is to stay ahead of things. Thing is, what about Hollywood writers' storylines? Do they include coronavirus in scripts right now, only to possibly scrap them later if things change? Hollywood's still on hold, but we'll hear how stories are shaping up when it finally gets the green light. That's coming up when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on kpcc.org. I'm Amy Martinez. Disney earnings take a dive. Meanwhile, writers are struggling with how to work the pandemic into storylines. Let's go on the lot.
God, I wish.
Stick your head out and yell.
You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
And we are led every Wednesday by Rebecca Keegan with The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Rebecca.
Hi there, eh?
All right. Biggest headline this week, I think, has to be the earnings loss reported by the Walt Disney Company. What's the damage there, Rebecca?
Well, Disney's earnings dropped 63% in the second quarter, and that is due overwhelmingly to its exposure on its theme parks, cruises, experiences, That sector of Disney's business alone lost $1 billion.
Yeah, parks, experiences, and products, right? That's the department that's hit hard by the global shutdown. What other parts, though, of the company are feeling it, too?
Well, ESPN ad revenue is down because, obviously, there's no sports to watch. The film studio is down because theaters are closed. One bright spot, though, is Disney Plus, the streaming service, which has been rolling out in Europe and in India this spring and bringing the total number of subscribers there up to 54.3 million.
I've been watching so much Marvel, so many Marvel movies on Disney Plus, Rebecca. I've been on the thing for pretty much every moment that I'm not here at work. Now, this quarterly report, is it a full representation of the pandemic's impact?
Well, no. I mean, obviously, the pandemic is still going on. There's still no live sports or movie theaters. The full impact won't be known for quite some time, because even after things are technically allowed to reopen, there may be a lag before people are willing to actually go.
Now, how has the company addressed the financial hit so far? Are they doing anything new maybe to try and curb some of these losses?
Well, they cut executive pay. They furloughed employees. They took out a line of credit. They're not going to be paying their semi-annual dividend to investors this summer. So that's probably, you know, the new thing that they're doing.
I think Bob Iger is taking, no salary, right? No, making no money right now.
That's correct, yeah.
So, okay, we're going to be hearing from other media companies as they report earnings. Can we expect similar losses across the media landscape, or does maybe the theme park element for Disney make that company particularly vulnerable right now?
Well, yeah. I mean, the theme parks are a bigger part of Disney's business than it is for the other studios. Universal has theme parks, but they're not as core to the business as theme parks are for Disney. And other studios like Warner Brothers, Sony, Fox, this is not a big part of their business. So they are not hit as hard as Disney has been.
Now, as I mentioned before, parks, one of the departments have been really hit the hardest, and there's no word on when Disneyland or Disney World will reopen. Shanghai Disneyland, though, plans are there to reopen very soon. How are they planning to do that?
Yeah, carefully.
Yeah.
They're looking at opening Shanghai Disneyland May 11th, which is Monday. Normally, that park has a capacity of 80,000 people, but under government restrictions, it's capped at 30%, so that would mean 24,000 visitors a day. Disney's saying they're initially going to open at an even lower capacity than that and slowly build to 24,000 people with social distancing in place. So, for instance, there are line markers on the rides like the kinds we've had at supermarkets here, instructing people on how far apart to stand, and masks will be mandatory.
But you still have to sit next to one on one of those rides, right? Or you have to be close to someone when you actually get to the front of the line. I'd be very interested to see how that happens on Monday. All right, so moving on now to the virtual writers' room. To include COVID or not to include COVID, because that's the question most show writers are grappling with right now. Why is that, Rebecca, such a complicated decision right now?
Well, TV shows that are set in the real world want to reflect that world. They want to feel authentic to audiences. But as my colleagues Lacey Rose and Leslie Goldberg write about in The Hollywood Reporter this week, TV writers face a dilemma because they're writing shows that will air at some unknown point in the future. Will people be absolutely so tired of the pandemic by then that they'll have no desire to see it represented on screen? Or, by contrast, will a show appear tone-deaf if it doesn't acknowledge, you know, what's been going on in the world? It's a question that all of these writers are grappling with in their virtual writers' rooms around town.
Yeah, and the other part of this, Rebecca, is, you know, just in reporting on all the stories, they seem to change week to week. One week something's a fact, then the next week it changes. So I can imagine for a Hollywood writer, they're wondering, okay, I can write something now that a month from now may not even be valid anymore. So that's got to be really, really frustrating.
Yeah, it is. And, one example that people bring up as another moment where the world changed dramatically is 9/11.
Yeah.
And at that time, some people included in their storylines, others didn't. But it's sort of, as Black-ish creator Kenya Barris points out in our article, 9/11 was a discrete day in our history. It was a complete story with a beginning, a middle, and an end. We don't really even know which act of the COVID-19 story we're in right now. Is it act one? Is it act two? Nobody knows, but it's certainly not over, and so it's hard to tackle from a narrative standpoint.
And the Hollywood Reporter spoke with several different show writers about how they were thinking about maybe addressing the pandemic. What are some examples?
Well, people are all over the map. Some shows are thinking of starting their seasons pre-pandemic and then introducing it midway through. Some people are saying they're going to avoid it entirely. Kenya Barris said he's thinking of writing into his show Grownish, which is about college life. But of course, we don't even know if colleges are going to open in the fall or if students will be in class virtually.
And then dramas will probably handle it a lot differently than, say, a sitcom or maybe even like a fantasy show, a superhero fantasy show. All those different shows will probably have different ways to handle it.
Right. I mean, so does it feel strange for characters to be, say, focusing on a romance when the pandemic is raging? You know, comedies face this challenging task of striking the right tone. The Curb Your Enthusiasm showrunner is quoted in our piece and did kind of crack me up musing about how that show might handle it, perhaps by pointing out all the people who are clearly breaking quarantine and lying about it, like getting a haircut every 4 weeks. So, I mean, the right writers can do something wonderful with this. It's just very hard.
I trust Larry David. In Larry, I trust, Rebecca. He'll handle it.
I agree.
Yeah, he'll handle it in a way where it's funny and thoughtful at the same time. We're talking to Rebecca Keegan with The Hollywood Reporter. Let's head to Texas now. That's where stay-at-home orders have been lifted. Some businesses have reopened with restrictions. They include 3 San Antonio movie theaters. Tell us about that, because I'm really interested to see how movie theaters are going to come back.
Yeah, so this is a small chain of movie theaters, Santikos Entertainment. They made $15,889 this past weekend, which is not a lot of money, clearly, by the standards of typical weekend box office, but this isn't a typical time. Tickets were discounted to about $5, and so that means about 3,000 people in San Antonio went to the theaters.
So what kind of standards were put into practice for their reopening? I mean, I'd love to know the mechanics of what they did. I still want to go back, Rebecca. I want to go back, but I don't know if I'm going to go back, you know, say opening weekend of a big movie anymore.
Right. Yeah. Maybe let them figure out the logistics. Yeah. Maybe go on a Tuesday matinee. Well, in this case, capacity was limited to 25%. Every other row was empty. Groups are seated 6 feet away from other groups. Armrests, cup holders, tray tables are disinfected between every screening. And there's no refills on soda or popcorn. So once you've used your container, it's trash.
So they do the seating plan that I always do anyway. I try to find the seats that are furthest away from everyone else just because I don't want to be near anyone that might get on their phone or start whispering. So I'm, yeah.
Right, but then there's always that one guy who sits directly in front of you, even though the entire theater is empty.
I know, and it almost ruins it for me. So I'm wondering, though, does this offer any clues at how the industry might want to do things when more theaters open up more widely?
Well, it definitely suggests that there's a certain amount of pent-up demand. So remember, there's nothing new to see. There's no new Marvel or Pixar or Fast and Furious movie or whatever else that is compelling people to go to the movie theaters right now. So 3,000 people went to see movies that have been out since January and February.
I'm still going to go back to the movies, Rebecca. I just can't guarantee Hollywood. You know, Hollywood gets my money a lot. I can't tell Hollywood for sure that I'm going to go back right away, but I do want to come back. That's the one thing I want more than sports, more than anything else, is to have that
more
movie
theater. More than sports?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Wow.
When you've lived sports for like 20 years like I used to, I've seen the whole show already. I don't need that show. I like movies now. Rebecca Keegan is with The Hollywood Reporter. She joins us every Wednesday to talk about the business of Hollywood. Rebecca, thanks a lot. See you next week.
Thanks, A.
All right, more than 8 decades ago, the U.S. found itself in an economic slump similar to the one we're facing today. Millions out of work, including thousands of musicians. A federal program, though, was there to help artists get back in tune, and a lot of those were out here in the West. That story's coming up when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Once I lived the life of a millionaire, spending my money now, did not care. Count my friends out for a good time, buying bootleg liquor, champagne and wine. Lord, but I got busted and I feel so low. Didn't have no money and no where to go. This is the truth, Lord, without a doubt. Nobody wants you when you're down. I mean,
back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org. I'm E. Martinez. More than eight decades ago, the U.S. found itself in an economic slump much like the one we're facing right now. It's a bleak chapter we now know as the Great Depression. Millions of people thrown out of work, including thousands of professional musicians. Take-Two's Austin Cross reports that many would have been forced to take up manual labor if not for a special federal program.
We're all alone, no chaperone can get our number. The world's in slumber, let's misbehave.
America in the late 1920s was much like America in early 2020. The stock market was up, and unemployment hovered around 4%. The country's rosy outlook was reflected in its music.
Let's misbehave.
But toward the end of the decade, everything changed.
1929. The financial house of cards collapses, and the overinflated stock market plunges into a Great Depression. A financial panic grips the world.
Film reels showed a changing America. Musicians told its story.
Once I built a railroad, made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
Once Depression hit the country hard, but it hit musicians harder. With no concerts to play, many fell into poverty. It would take 3 years, a new Congress, and a new president before fortunes started to shift.
Brother, can you spare a dime?
In March 1933, Congress passed a series of reforms aimed at pulling America out of the Depression. It was called the New Deal, which soon gave rise to the Works Progress Administration, or WPA.
Anxiously we waited for some sign of better days. Then came the federal government's work program. One by one, it took us out of the breadline. It gave us a new chance to take a normal place in the life of our community. It made us.
But the program wasn't just for laborers. The package also established the Federal Music Project, aimed at helping musicians.
The primary goal was simply to put professional musicians back to work.
Peter Goff is author of the book Sounds of the New Deal, The Federal Music Project in the West.
They had sold their instruments, some of them even before the Great Depression, because of the advent of the technology of the 1920s.
He's talking about the phonograph there. The Music Project would become one of four arts programs to receive federal funds, and one of the few to enjoy bipartisan support in the West.
You know, the Los Angeles papers in the 1930s were very, very conservative and Republican, and they tended to see the art projects or the cultural projects is what they called boondoggling. But there were several articles that said, look, we don't like all this WPA boondoggling, but this Federal Music Project, it's a good thing. We need to keep that.
At this time, it is our pleasure to present the Los Angeles Colored Chorus, a unit of the Works Progress Administration's Federal Music Project, under the direction of Dr. Nikolai Sokolov. Now a modern song based on a spiritual theme. Great day.
When times were dark, came Noah's Ark. Amen. When lion roared, came Daniel's Ark. Amen.
Under the project, musicians could do what they did best. Public concerts were subsidized by the federal government. Musicians were given a regular paycheck. Black and white artists were paid the same wages. What came out of it was a musical time capsule. Songs that didn't just celebrate Americana, but criticized it too.
I think people were reassessing what it meant to be an American in the 1930s. And there was a very popular song in the late 1930s, early 1940s, called Ballad for Americans. It's 12 minutes long, and it was originally sung by Paul Robeson on national radio. And it expresses all of these views.
Now hold on here. What are you trying to give us?
Are you an American?
Am I an American? I'm just an Irish, Negro, Jewish, Italian, French, and English, Spanish, Russian, Chinese, Polish, Scots, Hungarian, Litvak, Swedish, Finnish, Canadian, Greek, and Turk, and Czech, and double Czech American.
Peter Goff says music by Robeson and other artists of color would help erode racism in America, just in time for World War II. Diverse ensembles crossing the nation gently reminded audiences that they were in the Depression together.
Country's strong, our country's young, and the greatest songs are still unsung. From the
by the time the program was defunded in 1943, over 250,000 concerts had been performed, more than 7,300 works composed, many now forgotten. As the country stares down another economic whirlwind, musicians face the months ahead with none of the assurances afforded their forebears. The Federal Paycheck Protection Program offers limited funds for a short time, but it's unclear how long the latest injection of cash will last. In California, unemployment insurance and pandemic unemployment assistance can help make up for some lost earnings, but all of those programs come with significant hang-ups for performers. Now, given all this, one might wonder if musicians would benefit again from a program like the Federal Music Project. Peter Goff says yes.
Back in the 1930s and early 1940s, the Federal Music Project was actually performing on the radio. Four shut-ins was the term they used then, people who couldn't leave their home, which includes most of our citizenry today. So I think now, given the situation we have, and there are so many artists, and especially musicians who were playing in venues that people can no longer attend, it should definitely be a consideration.
If not for morale, and maybe for posterity. For Take Two, I'm Austin Cross.
Now wake up, boys. Get out on the rock. It ain't daybreak, but it's 4 o'clock.
Oh, no, 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 Pops. You know that ain't the play.
What you talking about? It's the WBA.
Oh, the WBA.
Now, I said that.
The WBA. Sleep while you work, while you rest, while you play. Lean on your shovel to pass the time away.
All right, well, I know that you guys out there tolerate me. You like the show. I know you like the show, but I know for a fact that you love the music on Take Two. You absolutely adore it. You've emailed me a lot of times over the past few weeks. Well, we've got something for you. We got a Take Two playlist on Spotify. You could find it on our website. That's take2.org, take2.org. And you can also find us wherever you want, wherever you find your podcast, too. Just look for the show, Take Two. There we will be, waiting to be heard by you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then. My rest until my work is through.